I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So, does everyone understand that compromise agreement on health care struck by a group of conservative and liberal Democrats in the Senate last night? Maybe not. Senate Majority Leader in Nevada, Democrat Harry Reid, declined to go into the details but said two key hurdles have been leapt, the public option and public abortion coverage. So let's take a few minutes to go behind that headline with Noam Levy, health policy reporter for the LA Times. He's there in D.C. Noam, let's start with the public option. As we read it, there'd no longer be a new government-run public option plan for the uninsured. Instead, the government would contract an outside nonprofit insurer to run a plan that the government would oversee. What's the difference?
Well, we're still trying to get all the details ourselves here, I should say, from the get-go. And Senate Majority Leader Reid nor any of the lawmakers who were working on this were telling us. So we're trying to figure out exactly what it is that they agreed to. But in broadest terms, it would be something like this. A strict government-run plan, which had been in previous versions of the legislation, would look more like Medicare, a plan in which the government pays and administers the insurance benefit in the same way that a private insurer does. The arrangement that's being discussed now as the possible compromise would put the government in a position of working with some private sector entity that would, in fact, administer the benefit. So there would essentially be a middleman between the government and the consumer. The way that the government works with other benefits that it provides, such as Medicaid, in many states, the states actually contract with private insurance companies that actually administer that benefit, but the government sets the benefits and provides sort of an oversight function in assuring that the benefits are being administered fairly.
How would this appease people who are against the public option? What does it mean to them that the government's not directly administering it?
Well, there's always been a fear among conservatives and Republicans that if the government is actually directly administering and running a government plan, that that's another step towards a single-payer system in which the government essentially takes over the function of paying for all the health care. There is a certain Rube Goldberg quality to this, but that's the nature of our process.
It's sausage that we're watching being made. And there's been a lot of criticism. The advocacy group Healthcare for America Now says right now half of people in private insurance are enrolled in nonprofit plans in private insurance, and they say that's part of the problem. Then you have Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, concerned about what they see as replacing a public option with a private, if nonprofit, approach. What's the sense that they, these Democrats, these much-needed Democratic votes, will be won?
Well, part of the compromise is to do a couple of other things, which are designed primarily to satisfy concerns on the left. One of the provisions would allow older Americans, 55 to 64, to buy into the federal Medicare program,
right,
which currently, you know, primarily serves Americans 65 and older and some disabled Americans who are younger. The other thing is that the compromise includes a form of a fallback or trigger that would allow the government to create a more traditional government plan if this nonprofit doesn't meet the objectives for affordability and quality that the government presumably wants.
Well, and you write that these deals on the public option came after the Senate rejected an attempt to tighten restrictions on federal funds for abortion that critics said would curb access to abortion, even for women buying insurance with their own money. The Senate said flat out no. What happens now?
Well, the compromise that was worked out yesterday has to be sent to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which will assess how much it costs. When they come back with a what's called a score, then that will be discussed, I'm sure, in great at great length by the full 60-member Democratic caucus, and presumably that will be included in a package of amendments that would change the underlying bill and would be voted on probably in the next week or two.
It feels like we've been saying that for a year now, but it may be getting close to reality.
I think we're in the seventh or eighth inning here.
Noam Levy, health policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
There is some good news about workplace injuries. They're happening less. In 2007, 4 million workers were injured on the job, 5,600 killed. Now, that's terrible, terrible. But those numbers are way down from 1992. The bad news? Those numbers are wrong. According to the Government Accountability Office, the GAO reports that employers and workers routinely underreport work-related injuries and deaths to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. Now, let's remind ourselves, workers' compensation is what's called a no-fault system. The workers give up the right to sue their employers if they're injured in exchange for medical benefits when they are injured. But our first guest says it doesn't always work that way. Stephen Greenhouse is labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. He's also author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Steve, you say the system, which we want you to explain, encourages underreporting, but also this idea that there's a quid pro quo, you know, no lawsuits in exchange for medical care, doesn't always work. How so? What's the problem?
The problem is, Robin, that it turns out not to be so no fault. We did a three-part workers' comp series, and I examined at length a worker whose job was grinding metal to make tools in Rochester, New York. He got terrible lung disease from all the cobalt he was grinding, and he collapsed several times at work and had to be taken to the emergency room. And this gentleman, Fred Ouellette, told me that the day after he informed his employer that he was applying for workers' comp benefits, he was fired. All employers have to pay workers' compensation, and the more injuries at their workplace, the higher they have to pay workers' comp. Also, all employers with more than 10 workers have to report to the federal government any injury that's actually more serious than first aid. So employers feel an incentive to hide injuries, not to report injuries, for several reasons. One, the more injuries, the higher their workers' comp insurance premiums are going to be, and sometimes premiums can be $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 per worker. Second, the more injuries that a company records on its so-called injury logs, the more likely an agency like OSHA is going to send an investigator to say what's wrong here, and companies really want to avoid that as well.
Well, and as you said, employers with more than 10 workers have to record every injury or illness that isn't first aid. And you write that, you know, that distinction is why some employers try to shop around to find a doctor that will call an injury something that just needs first aid?
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling. So that way the employer doesn't have to record the injury.
In other words,
according to some studies, believe it or not, employers report one-third of the actual injuries that occur at their workplaces.
So they'll try to find a doctor who will say, oh, this just needs an ice pack. It's not sprained or broken, and they don't need to go home. Well, why would employees underreport their injuries?
That's a good question, and it's very surprising. I've written about many workplaces where they have games like safety bingo, so that if there's no injury for 30 days, someone might win a bingo pot and take home $300. Or there are bonuses or steak dinners if there are no injuries for 3 months. So workers feel a lot of pressure, kind of peer pressure, not to report injuries. Everyone's going to say, oh, Joe, he really screwed things up. We're losing our steak dinner because of him. And that's quite prevalent at many, many workplaces across the nation. So I think a lot of workers just try to keep their head down. We don't even report the injury. We say that it happened at home when we were playing, touch football or something. So we just see our regular doctor rather than go through the workers' comp system.
Well, where are, the regulatory agencies or someone who would sort of offset these kinds of practices? Where is OSHA in this? Where are union representatives or workers' representatives?
Well, unions only represent, 7% of the nation's private sector workers, so they're much weaker than before. In the workplaces where there are unions, they're really trying to make sure that, many employers do the right thing. OSHA is now trying to get more aggressive under President Obama. Some of the people leading OSHA now really look askance at these safety bingo and safety bucks and safety bonuses. They think that all those incentives sometimes often discourage workers from coming forward and reporting injuries. Plus, OSHA is now, partly as a result of this report by the Government Accountability Office, OSHA is trying to really do a much better job in policing workplaces and making sure that employers report all the injuries that their workers suffer.
And by the way, this isn't just something that employees say is happening. The GAO also spoke to the doctors who are in occupational health practices. What do they say?
That's a good point, Robin. The Government Accountability Office did some surveys of doctors, health practitioners who work at companies, and 53% of those health practitioners reported that they experienced pressure from company officials to play down injuries or illnesses. 67% said they reported observing workers who were scared of disciplinary action if they reported an injury or an illness. And three-quarters of the health practitioners at companies said they believe workers sometimes deliberately avoided reporting work-related injuries and illnesses as a result of these, these incentive programs like steak dinners and safety bingo.
Well, meantime, you say OSHA is going to be beefed up under the current administration, but how does it operate now? I mean, does it have even enough people to go out and do random checks? Does it, have regularly scheduled checks? How does it work?
Some people argue OSHA does not have enough inspectors, and OSHA says it's going to add 100 investigators. It does regular checks at all companies that experience or that report more than X number of injuries. Every company is supposed to have an injury log, and if the number of injuries in the log exceed a certain amount, that company will be investigated. But a lot of the times, they visit companies because of complaints by unions or by individual workers. Some people say that OSHA should visit companies at random and not focus so much on the number of injuries in the injury logs because, as we've discussed, Robin, many companies underreport, many workers underreport.
Well, we know that Iowa Senator Tom Harkin has asked for the GAO report. He's chair of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. But in the meantime, it seems like it really goes against at least a media caricature of the worker who's been caught on tape, who said he had a bad back and he's out dancing or gardening or skiing. The perception is that it's the worker who's faking an injury as opposed to what you're saying, which is the worker who's hiding an injury.
Well, there's both type of fraud and manipulation. There are workers who try to, get away with not working and make believe they're injured. But the many, many experts I've interviewed on this say that there's much greater dollar fraud by employers, by underreporting injuries, by, some employers might have 300 workers, but they report to workers' comp that they only have 200 workers, so they only have to pay premiums for 200 workers. Mm-hmm. Or many companies say that their workers aren't really employees but are mere independent contractors, and therefore the employers don't have to pay workers' comp premiums on them, and if the workers get injured on the job, tough luck. We're not paying for it. It's your problem. So many, many experts I interview say, yes, there are employees engaging in fraud, but much worse is the fraud by employers, and coupled with that are the many workers who are scared to step up and report that they've been injured.
Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Okay, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, underreported deaths from toxic chemicals at work. Also later today, Bangladeshis don't need a conference to tell them the effects of global warming. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about underreported workplace injuries. Reported cases are down, but our next guest says every 8 minutes in the U.S., someone dies from an occupational illness or injury when you take into account often unreported on-the-job exposures to toxic chemicals. That would mean up to 60,000 people a year die from occupational illnesses. That's more than the total of breast cancer deaths and more than twice the number of prostate cancer deaths. Dr. Patrice Weppel is a retired health and hospitals administrator and author of the book Depraved Indifference, The Workers' Compensation System. She joins us from the studios of NPR member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. And Patrice, you've written that OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has fewer inspectors today than in 1975 and can inspect workplaces on average only once in 133 years. And you say it's also deficient in the amount of chemicals it regulates. How so?
In its almost 40 years of existence, OSHA has established PELs, permissible exposure limits, in other words, regulating the amount of a certain chemical that can be used in the workplace. It has regulated only 500 chemicals out of the 100,000 plus chemicals that are in use in workplaces. By comparison, the European Union regulates 30,000 chemicals, and many that we allow here haven't been allowed there for decades. And let me just give you one example of why, if I may.
Please.
I'll just talk about asbestos. Back in the 1930s, a study was done, but this was done by industry, the industry that was using asbestos, and it revealed that half of all asbestos workers had lungs that showed classic signs of asbestosis on X-ray. Well, they, of course, didn't want that information released. Well, in this case, finally, after a long fight, the results were revealed in 1970. And EPA at that point began research. It spent 10 years in research on asbestos, millions of dollars, and 100,000 pages of research and testimony. And finally, it banned asbestos in 1989, a logical conclusion to their research, right?
Mm-hmm.
It stayed banned for 2 years, at which point industry brought them to court. And the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court acknowledged that asbestos is a potential carcinogen at all levels of exposure, but they nevertheless threw it out on a technicality. So this is the kind of thing that they run up against.
Well, and by the way, we should say you have filed a workers' compensation claim. Millions of Americans have. Yours was for an injury, a physical injury, you know, sustained
right.
at work. But you're talking about toxic chemicals. And in this case, it may not show up for decades after
right.
people have left the workplace. You tell the stories of American workers in your book. Pick one for us and how the system, you believe, failed them.
This is a case of a mid-40s young man in very good health. On a contract basis, he went to work for an air conditioning and refrigeration service company. Was using lye, sodium hydroxide, to clean the surfaces. I'm talking here about very large industrial HVAC systems
mm-hmm.
and in very hot states, Florida, Georgia, etc. And within 11 months, he was dead. Now, he was not given the proper mask. He was given a cheap paper mask when he should have had a full face respirator. And he died from his work. His wasn't even reported to OSHA.
Why not?
By the time he died, he was no longer working for the company. It was 11 months after he had first started working for them and probably about 9 months after he had left the company.
What do you want to see happen? How do things change?
Here is a major thing that has to change in this country. One of the reasons why we have so little in terms of, in other words, only 500 pills and they're all woefully out of date and inadequate, and so many chemicals that we use that aren't even regulated at all, is because the way we look at it is to put the cost on the government to take the time to do the research and to prove that it's not a danger. Whereas in Europe, what they do is it is up to the producer, the manufacturer, the employer to prove that the chemical is safe.
Hmm.
You see, we completely turn it around. So that we get things like what I talked about with asbestos or benzene. We know that benzene is a carcinogen at all levels, but the American Petroleum Institute was able to bring a case which went all the way up to the Supreme Court. They claimed that the statute required OSHA to demonstrate a significant risk of harm in order to justify setting a particular exposure level. And that's part of the problem.
So, Patrice Whipple, you're saying that you think the burden needs to be shifted and that it's backwards.
Absolutely.
Europe's got it right. Well, that reminds me that you originally wrote us as a listener after a story we did on proposals in healthcare reform that more companies institute wellness programs that sort of reward and encourage workers to maintain better health by giving them breaks in insurance if they do that, or some would say punishing them through higher costs if they don't. And you were very
mm-hmm.
and you were very upset about that thingy because it seemed to you like the same kind of, you know, shifting the burden to the worker.
Well, it's been by design. We seem to be very focused in this country on controlling personally generated health problems such as smoking, weight gain, etc., what we eat. Almost no attention being paid to this monumental corporate generated health problems which are killing 50 to 60,000 workers a year, and by extension, those toxins go into the air, the water, the soil.
So it sounds like you're saying, Patrice, that while companies are shaking their fingers at employees for, let's say, bad eating habits,
yes,
their own behavior is the equivalent, the far worse, far
absolutely
worse than the equivalent of
absolutely
eating.
Absolutely, yes.
Patrice Whipple is a retired health and hospitals administrator, author of the book Depraved Indifference, The Workers' Compensation System. She's been speaking to us from Amherst, Massachusetts. Patrice, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Temperatures are rising in Copenhagen. Poorer developing countries are furious about a leaked plan that would require them to limit their carbon emissions more than wealthy countries. But officials say the text is just one of several ideas, not an agreement. Developing countries are also upset with the amount of money richer countries are offering them to fight climate change, saying the $10 billion a year being offered them pales in comparison to the $1 trillion spent to rescue financial institutions. Well, mayors from the world's largest cities are holding their own summit in Copenhagen this week, including Mexico City Mayor Marcelo Ebrard. Historically, Mexico City has had some of the worst air pollution in the world, and while the air quality has improved in the past decade, 4,000 people still die every year from smog-related illnesses. Mayor Ebrard is working to change that, and Harvard University recently honored him for launching the city's Metrobus system, which cut 80,000 tons of carbon emissions a year. That's like taking 15,000 cars off the road. We spoke with the mayor on his recent trip to Boston, and he told us why it's time for Mexico City to clean up its act.
When I started to work in the city, the Mexico City government several years ago, we have an environmental crisis, which was the air pollution was so high that you have a really health emergency in the city. We don't have time to really, you know, postpone the decisions.
Yeah. I was wondering if 4,000 residents of Mexico City are dying a year now of, you're nodding yes, of smog-related, you know, give or take, what must it have been 10 years ago?
No, a complete disaster.
Mexico City is also going to replace those little green Volkswagen cabs that we all know with more fuel-efficient taxis. You're bringing in pedicabs. Mexico City has banned plastic bags. You've proposed a $5.5 billion project for green roofs to plant 500,000 square feet of gardens on rooftops. All sound wonderful to environmentalists, but we were thinking, where do you get the money for this?
Well, we change priorities in the city. For instance, if you are going to put the money on the new freeways in the city, or you are going to put this kind of money in public transportation facilities. So we change priorities in order to get the money to expand the public transportation facilities of the city, which is the most important thing to do.
You know, you can change the infrastructure, but the other part is changing people's minds. And I understand that the first thing, your eyes just rolled, that the first Monday of every month, is it bike day or something? And you ride a bike?
I use the bike in order to run to the office because I cannot ask the people to use the bike if I don't. It doesn't make sense.
Do people do it? Do more people hop on bikes on the first Monday of every month?
Yes, in the government. But also, we close the most important avenue in the city only for pedestrians and bike users weekends, which was, you know, the second step to send a message to open to the people to a new ideas.
Yeah.
The third step, we closed the most important street for the downtown area, which is Madero Avenue, a very important avenue, only for pedestrians. So it's a real change in the priorities in the city because it used to be the cars, always the cars.
Back to some of the questions about all of this. People say it's great, money into metro buses, money into new subway lines, green roofs, and the bike system. But that's less money for Mexico City's water infrastructure. You have pretty tough problems with water. We know some parts of Mexico, the aquifers have been overused. The city, parts of the city, sinking by 10 inches a year. A third of the drinking water pumped from river basins 80 miles away. What do you say to people who say, do the water first, you know, before the travel?
Yeah, they have a legitimate point. Next year, we are going to increase the taxes and payments and the price of the water in the city in order to control and change the behavior of the people about the water. And we obtained a year ago the support of the Federal Congress with some money in order to improve the infrastructure of water in the city. And next year is going to be this change in the price of the water.
That's Marcelo Ebrard, mayor of Mexico City. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure to see you.
Okay, we'll be back in 30 seconds with a trip to Bangladesh to see how that coastal country is already adapting to rising sea levels brought on by climate change. In about 30 seconds, here and now. The World Meteorological Organization gave urgency to the climate change talks in Copenhagen, Denmark yesterday by presenting data that showed that this decade is proving to be the hottest since 1850, when records first were kept. 2009 is shaping up as the fifth warmest year ever. So much for those cynical emails. Well, while the higher temperatures may have been news to delegates at the conference, many developing nations such as Bangladesh are already feeling the effects of climate change. Science reporter Dan Grossman brings us this story from the Sundarbans Islands, which are spread across Bangladesh and West Bengal in India.
Mohammed Sheikh Ghafoor once farmed 25 or 30 acres of rice and chili peppers and raised fish in shallow freshwater ponds. With his wife and six sons, he built a house of baked mud. But about 12 years ago, the thin dike protecting his land breached in a cyclone. Ghafoor and his wife now live in this tea shop, a beach hut made of plastic tarps hung from a frame of bamboo poles. His sons, scattered elsewhere, work the land of others.
Who thought about us? We're the people who lost our land.
Here at his tea house, Ghafoor, my interpreter and I are joined by a couple of local farmers in an animated discussion about the hardships of island life and what might be done to relieve them.
We're fed up with telling people our story. It's no use. They just listen, and when they leave, nothing happens.
As a younger man in the world's largest democracy, Mohammed Sheikh Ghafoor took an active interest in politics. But over many years, a succession of natural disasters and failed attempts by the Indian government to mitigate them has left him embittered.
This is impossible for our government to do in our lifetimes. The only thing that the government can do now is pull out all the people from the islands.
Because of sea level rise, a lot of islands which are now being inhabited by people, that is 52 islands, will be not livable anymore.
Shugoto Hazra, an oceanographer at Calcutta's Jadavpur University, predicts India's Sundarbans Islands will lose 15% of their area by 2020, about 13 square miles, displacing up to 100,000 people.
So people are losing their homeland and they are becoming a kind of environmental migrant.
Hazra says that as climate change takes its course, environmental migrants will increasingly strain social services in India and the highly populated coastal delta of Bangladesh, just north of Calcutta on the Bay of Bengal. Bangladesh, home to 150 million, is the seventh most populous country in the world, although it's only about the size of Louisiana. Most of Bangladesh is less than 40 feet above sea level. For many months each year, more than 10% of the country's surface is water. With sea level expected to rise up to 3 feet in this century, an additional 10 to 20% of Bangladesh will be permanently lost, displacing millions of people and destroying farmlands and fresh water supplies.
Bangladesh is nature's laboratory on natural disaster. We have floods, we have droughts, we have heat waves, we have riverbank erosion, we have storm surges, we have cyclones, we have tornadoes.
Ainun Nishat is Bangladesh's representative to the International Union for Conservation of Nature and an advocate of the view that his country must find its own strategy to adapt to the effects of global warming.
Now, there are forces among NGOs who would like to see the government spend more energy on environmental refugees or climate change refugees and inundation from the sea and those sort of things. I believe that's Western agenda. That's not Bangladesh's agenda.
Nishat says the world has underestimated how resilient his country is in the face of natural disasters of the sort its people have faced for millennia.
So having said that, am I not worried about sea level rise? Answer is yes and no. I'm not worried against inundation of the land and people migrating because their houses would be underwater.
I knew Nishat believes his country will develop the necessary infrastructure to protect its people from the slow but inexorable rise of the sea.
But I'm worried because in the coastal area, the frequency of this cyclonic event would increase, like the cyclone Sidr.
Bangladesh is used to large-scale natural disasters and cyclones, but the people here are still in shock at this sudden violence.
On November 15, 2007, Cyclone Sidr struck Bangladesh with 140-mile-per-hour winds and 20-foot waves. After the storm had passed, 3,000 to 5,000 people were dead, and 10 times that were injured.
The closer that we've got to the coast, the more damage that we've seen, like here, this whole row of shops, which has just been swept.
Half a million houses were destroyed. Because of global warming, storms of this magnitude are expected not only to become more frequent, but also to penetrate farther inland as the sea level rises. And for this, Bangladesh is not prepared, says Ainu Nishat.
I had the privilege of talking to Senator John Kerry in Bali. And after some discussion, Senator Kerry pointed me and said, if I could give one thing to you from the United States to address your climate change concern, what would you ask for? I said, I would ask for long-term meteorological forecast. We need some satellite information. We need more modeling experience. This is an advanced technology. We need that.
Just as global warming is increasing at an ever faster rate, so will the population of Bangladesh rise to an estimated 300 million by mid-century. The difficulty of growing enough food here increases as global warming creates conditions favorable to more frequent and more severe storms, and rising sea level compounds the flooding caused by storm surges. For example, in 2007, storms and flooding wiped out 6% of Bangladesh's rice harvest. Atiq Rahman, director of the Bangladesh Center for Advanced Studies, an environmental think tank, says such disasters have wide-ranging consequences.
The political implication, the social implication of food security is big here. You know, the food prices control whether government stays or government goes.
Rahman says his country's most important priority should be securing its food supply, and he wants the rest of the world to understand what's at stake for developing nations like his.
Because, as you know, more than half of Bangladesh is really poor, abject poverty. And among the poor in the total budget, 60 to 70% is food, while for the rich American, it's 3 to 10%.
Welcome back. What can art mean for people who don't have food? That question is particularly relevant to Betty LaDuke. She's Emeritus Professor of Art at Southern Oregon University. For the past 30 or so years, she's been traveling to developing countries, painting colorful murals of people, like the three slender women from Tanzania in orange and beige dresses, holding bowls with green bananas on their heads, surrounded by brown and white horned cows. Ah, cows. Most recently, Betty's been working with Heifer International, the organization that helps you donate an animal like a cow or a goat to a family in an impoverished country. Heifer International makes a terrific Christmas catalog. We'll link you to it on our website, hereandnow.org. But for those who wonder, does this really work? Betty offers proof. She recently went on a series of trips to sketch and then paint the people impacted by Heifer's work. The result is the new book, Dreaming Cows, the paintings, murals, and drawings of Betty LaDuke celebrating Heifer International. It's written by Susan Jo Boumegan. And Betty LaDuke joins us from her home in Ashland, Oregon, with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
We want to talk about the work with Heifer International, but a little about you, because we know you were born in the Bronx. Your parents had emigrated from Ukraine and Poland in the 20s, and you lived in this wonderful neighborhood of immigrants. Do you think that sort of polyglot neighborhood and childhood lent itself to this interest in others?
In a way, I would say, and the idea of knowing early on that I loved to sketch, loved to draw, and the sketchbook was what I took with me as I explored New York City and became unafraid of just walking everywhere, anywhere, and connecting with people, their lives, their situations.
Well, and your story continues. In the 50s, you were in Mexico. You observed the murals of Diego Rivera. You primarily sketching women, women grinding or kneading corn dough, women working. It ends up being a very strong theme in your paintings. You call these women contemporary goddesses. Tell us more about them.
I find, as I travel in so-called third world cultures, that the women are powerful in terms of holding the family together, in terms of the kind of work they have to do for just simple, basic survival. Any issues I felt when I came home seemed so small in contrast to the heroic efforts of what I experienced through my travels.
Well, women and women trying to feed their families is obviously a recurring theme in the new book, the collection of paintings that have to do with people who've received the benefits of the Heifer organization. But there are men, too. Well, look, here's a grandfather with a chicken on his head. I'm looking.
Right, yes, and he's in one of the large paintings from Eastern Europe.
Right, this is on a page entitled Albania and Kosovo. And you write, the grandfather sat down, took off his shoes, and smoked a cigarette while I sketched. The chicken just stayed on his head. When they finally took the chicken off his head, it wandered into my bedroom where it proceeded to lay an egg on my bed. That's my story.
Yes. I loved his wife and had sketched her first, and he insisted that I sketch him too, so he had to wait till the following morning. So he was there bright and early, 7 a.m., sitting out there waiting. And he ended up in the painting as well as his wife called, "We May Be Poor, But Our Culture Is Rich."
Well, and what else do these paintings tell us? First of all, you do them in these incredibly vibrant colors. It does feel a little Diego Rivera, sort of almost a primitive look sometimes to the people and the animals. Bright, bright colors. They're supposed to be in poverty.
Yes, that's there too. But color is a choice that people often make within their own cultures and how they dress, also their artwork, so that color is like life, it's like sun, it's like flowers, and somewhere it's an important part of people's identity. And throughout the world, you know, women have been keepers of the color in many ways, as far as the work that they've done to embellish the ordinary, to make it extraordinary.
Well, for instance, I'm looking at the page entitled Cambodia, Mrs. Sim Rowan's Ducks.
Yes.
This is a woman who was a 42-year-old impoverished farmer in a village in Cambodia, mother of five, with an abusive husband with chronic illness, owned no animals or agricultural tools, couldn't send her kids to school, and then Heifer trained her as a village animal health worker, and her life has blossomed.
Right.
How does your painting of her show that?
Well, I recall the moment when I sketched first and tried to get the feeling of this woman with much pride feeding her ducks. Mostly it was just that moment that seemed to capture for me how her life moved forward with the way Heifer approaches a community. Heifer has quite a process. They determine which are the poorest areas, people in need, and they determine which would be the best animals for them. And then there's a training period where people have to commit to learning, attending meetings so that they can understand how to take care of an animal. Then it goes beyond that. They have to sign a contract to pass on the animal after it's been bred to other needy neighbors. It's all done in a sustainable way so that every part of the animal, the manure, the urine, all of this can be used to help with the crops and to help improve the soil.
I'm on a page entitled Rwanda, Celebrating the Gift of the Heifer, Consolation. And there's a photograph of these beautifully dressed African women. They've got sort of saris, you know, draped over them. And there's your first sketch. And then there's the final painting. Why heifer consolation? They received three cows. What does that mean, consolation?
Consolation may have been for them such grief that they suffered during the many years of genocide that took place. My first trip Elizabeth Heffer with a study group that went to Rwanda. And at that time, I was like very skeptical. I knew very little about Heffer. And I thought, what difference could cows make to a community, to a nation that has suffered like this? And I've been back twice now with Heffer and seen the difference. And when people receive animals, there's a great deal of joy. So in that painting that you're referring to, the women are celebrating. They're dancing with their arms uplifted, and they all look forward to receiving the benefit of the heifers, the cows, the offspring, and just expanding their life quality.
And what I love is whether it's their arms or sometimes in other pictures, a field of corn or something, there's sometimes no end to the image, so that their arms sort of keep going up and blend with the sky, and the field might just keep on going.
Yeah, it goes on. There's a sense of continuity, a sense of timelessness.
Well, and the women are quoted saying, before we received heifers, we had no hope in life. So their thanks to Heifer International. But you also received thanks from another woman in Nigeria, and her letter is in the preface to the book. She writes, I want to say I love you, Betty, for all you've done to let the outside world know something about, in this case, her and her research. In the end, she says, more grease to your elbow, Betty.
Yes, that was Princess Elizabeth Oluwu. And that was my first trip to Africa in 1986, where my focus was researching women artists, because the men artists were fairly well known. And she was perhaps the very first one I met, an amazing professor who sculpted life-size figures. And that, when I began to connect with Heffer, I had a background of travel, so that Heffer gave me a proactive understanding. Rather than being an observer and reporting only what I saw, I could report a sense of momentum and, how something given is passed on and makes a difference for the future.
Well, Betty LaDuke, more grease to your elbow.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you.